I'm just going to start off by saying my name is Carlin Forner, and it's April 16th, and we're at the SNCC 50th Anniversary Conference, and it's about 2:33 in the afternoon. And so I'm going to start off with asking you, what's your name, birth date, and age?
My name is Arlene Dunn. My maiden name was Arlene Will Corvin, and I was born June 17th, 1942, so that makes me 67 years old.
All right, and where were you born?
I was born in Boston, Massachusetts, and grew up in Dorchester, in the Dorchester area, the Jewish section. Oh, I didn't turn my...
Oh, that's all right, don't worry about it. All right, well, were your parents involved in organizations that were, like, organizations, like movement organizations and things like that?
No.
All right. Well, growing up in Boston, or in the Massachusetts area, did you have a sense of racial issues as a child?
No, I did not. I would say, I mean, part of my story is when I did become aware
mm-hmm.
of race as an issue, which I guess I was a teenager.
All right.
At that point. So,
and can you tell me about
yes.
that? Yeah, absolutely.
So, in 1957, I was a student at a girls' Latin school, which was a citywide high school. So I wasn't going to a regional high school. So I was in a school that was a little diverse because people came from all over the city. I wouldn't say that there was a lot of people of color in the school, but interestingly enough, we sat alphabetically, this was 50s after all,
mm-hmm.
And I sat behind a girl who it was African American. Her name was Lily White, which always gets a laugh,
mm-hmm.
but anyway. And I truthfully did not think about race at all. It just didn't even enter my consciousness much of anything. I certainly, at that time, had never heard of Brown v. Board. I'd never heard of Emmett Till. I'd never heard of Rosa Parks. I had never heard of any of this. But I was in high school, and I was a good student, and I was studying hard. And I came home and saw pictures on our television set. We were fortunate enough to have a TV of the Little Rock Nine trying to integrate Central High School. And I could not believe my eyes. Except for color, these boys and girls were just like me. They dressed like me. They carried the... And what totally freaked me out was the anger and hatred in the eyes of the parents of the white students, adults. They should know better. I mean, I was just floored. I didn't know this existed in our country. I had no idea. And then to see the National Guard in uniform actually preventing them from entering the building, this was very disturbing to me. So that was my first really awareness
mm-hmm.
Of race as an issue in our country.
So from that moment, how did you get involved in the movement then? What was your path to that?
So I graduated from high school in 1959. I went to Brandeis University, and my mind was thirsty for anything. I mean, I was just really interested in everything that was happening. And in February of 1960, I'm sure there must have been a sign in the student union or something about, if you're interested in supporting the sit-ins and the self, come go to this meeting. And, so it turns out maybe, every Saturday for a while, and I can't remember how many Saturdays we went, but every Saturday, a few of us, probably two carloads, drove to Harvard Square and picketed in front of Woolworths, sometimes in snow, which I thought was somewhat of a sacrifice, but hardly in comparison to what these students were doing in the South. And so this was the first political demonstration, the first demonstration of any kind I'd ever done. I do have to say, though, even as a youngster, I was other-oriented. So I did, like, March of Dimes. I would collect dimes for the March of Dimes and infantile paralysis then. I did trick-or-treat for UNICEF. So, you know, I had a certain kind of consciousness about not being so concerned about my own self.
Where do you think that came from?
You know, I don't know. I always try to tell my mother, who was very upset about my involvement in the movement, that it must have been her that trained me in all of this. She always talked to me about, you know, treating people fairly and doing the right thing and that kind of stuff. But the truth of the matter is that I had a brother and a sister, and neither one of them did anything like what I did. But I was probably a bit of a rebel from the beginning, and kind of outside the mold, if you will. And I did go to Girls Latin School. I was intent on going to college even when I was in fifth and sixth grade. That was a real dream of mine. And my mother was very encouraging of that. She had wanted to go to college, but was prevented because of the Depression from being able to fulfill her dreams. So she kind of instilled that in me. But even at Girls Latin School, my senior year was the first time that physics was taught in our school, and that was because I and a few other of the math whizzes in the school started petitioning the school to offer physics. Here we were in Sputnik era, and we should be studying physics. It hurt me a little bit that, you know, MIT was still like all men then, and I found it kind of curious that here we were in this Sputnik thing, and people weren't trying to get me to go into math and engineering, because I was such a math person. But that was then.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so how did you, or where did you go from protesting outside of Harvard Square and
okay.
Harvard Square to?
So, you know, I did a few other, I participated in a couple of other protests. My first time I ever did a march on Washington was in 1961 for a protest against nuclear testing in the atmosphere. And we did this silent march. It was 8,000 people. We thought it was a humongous number of people. And then in my senior year, I met Chuck McDew, who was then chairman of SNCC, or was soon to be chairman of SNCC. I can't remember the years he was actually chairman. He spent a year at Brandeis. And I met him and became good friends with him and learned a lot about what SNCC was doing. And, you know, found it interesting, but I still wasn't, I wasn't on a path to go to work for SNCC. I mean, I was on a path to graduate and to find a job and fulfill that part of my life. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, I ended up moving to New York when I finished school. It turns out Chuck also was living in New York at that time, so we continued our friendship there. And as a result, I met people in the New York SNCC office, which had quite a substantial operation there and provided a lot of support and financial and otherwise to SNCC. And so I started volunteering in the evenings and found that this was very fulfilling. I met a lot of people that I liked and that I agreed with politically and socially. I mean, we got along socially as well. And so we worked hard in the office, we played hard, we did a lot of good things. And the head of the SNCC office in New York, Julie Prettyman, her name was then, it's now Poussant, in a breakout session at this week, she made mention of how the New York office provided a haven, an R&R haven for the workers. And so as a result, I got to meet a lot of folk who were working in the trenches. And this, I think, really started to inspire me and to think about doing more than just volunteering in the office. But, you know, here I was just out of school. I had finally gotten a job and I was pretty settled. And in when work started to build for the 64 Summer Project, and the New York office was very busy raising money and raising other resources to support the Summer Project. So we were very, very busy. We were either stuffing envelopes, inviting people to some event, or just asking them to send money, or we were opening envelopes with the money they sent in. And it was really encouraging to see all this activity. And then in June, when Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner were came up missing, you know, this was just a devastating blow to everybody. The New York office bought a full-page ad in the New York Times looking for more support in response to this, and how we needed better cars, stronger cars, more resources to help with security. And we were overwhelmed with the response. It was incredible. So we were there many, many hours opening envelopes and sorting checks and money and other things. We got our share of hate mail as well. And one night I opened a piece of hate mail that actually had a piece of feces in the envelope. And I was just shocked. I thought, you know, how much hate you have to actually put your finger on this and do this. And I said to myself, I can't let these people scare me off and make me feel like I should be afraid. Now, of course, I had not gone through the training. I talked to Julie, again, the director of the SNCC office in New York, and asked her, do you think, even without the training, there might be a spot for me? Well, and it wasn't just one conversation, it was probably many conversations. And she was like a mother to us, I mean, even though she's not that much older than the rest of us. But she came back and said, if you go to Atlanta, they might be able to find a spot for you, and that's where the main office was. So I quit my job in a moment's notice. I broke a lease. I don't know what I did with my stuff. Maybe I packed some stuff up and sent it to my mother. Maybe I just gave it all to Goodwill. I don't really know. I don't remember. But, you know, I took a suitcase, maybe two, got on a bus and went to Atlanta. And, you know, I hung around there and helped out whatever. There was plenty to do in the Atlanta office, and I was helping out as much as I could, even though they didn't know who I was. And within about a week or 10 days, they said, okay, we have an opening in Arkansas if you'd like to go to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. So I said, yeah, sure. So I got on a bus, another bus, and I went to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. This was a small project, maybe a dozen people there. I think partly because I hadn't really gone through the training, and also partly because I was pretty good at office organizing. I was a good organizer and that kind of stuff. So I was primarily responsible for keeping things together in the office. And I did a lot of typing and running off. I did a lot of the mimeographing and writing notes and newsletters and this kind of stuff. And I did, however, have the opportunity occasionally to do a little canvassing and also to participate in an occasional demonstration. We did some demonstrations. One, I think, was about retail, and I can't remember what it was about, but whatever. I remember taking part, and I remember meeting a very handsome young man, African-American, who was a lawyer, and I was just really impressed that there were professional blacks in Pine Bluff. But at the same time, I also had an opportunity to do a little canvassing, voter registration and other kinds of organizing, grassroots organizing, canvassing with some people. And I remember being so taken somewhat aback at the level of poverty that people were living in. I don't think I'd ever witnessed this kind of poverty in my life. And I thought we were relatively poor, so, but in comparison, we were, you know, on streets of honey. Nonetheless, their homes were always very clean and orderly. I remember one house had two pictures on the wall, one of John F. Kennedy and the other of Martin Luther King. I thought, well, that was, I took note of that and remember it to this day. In about 6 months, the Arkansas Project decided to open a state office and to expand some of its other activities in addition to Pine Bluff. So we opened an office in Little Rock. I mean, the Pine Bluff office was essentially the state office until then. We opened an office in Little Rock and expanded some activities, and we had some activities in West Helena and West Memphis and a couple of other places. Again, my job now, it was even more administration because there was more projects to keep track of, and but I was content to do that and felt like it was a good spot for me. Now, in 1964, the Civil Rights Bill, or the Public Accommodations Bill, was passed, and that went into effect on January 1st of 1965. And on January 1st, 1965, we're probably starting in December, lots of restaurants put up signs and suddenly became private clubs. That was their way of getting around the new law. And well, we kind of thought about that and wondered what we might be able to do about that. But then we got wind of the fact that the cafeteria in the basement of the Capitol building was now a private club. And we thought, wow, the most public building in the state of Arkansas that's owned by the public is going to have a private club in the basement of the cafeteria. So we put a plan into motion. Nancy Stoller, who was another white woman on the project, and me went to eat there two or three times, maybe even four times. There was a guard at the post. He never questioned our going in. We made it our business to engage him in conversation so he would be sure to remember us. And we went in and ate. We actually ate. And we came back with about, I think the first day we went was with about 15 people, but the numbers don't really matter. So like many Capitol buildings, the basement is this very large open rotunda with a lot of marble and marble stairs and marble floors and this kind of stuff. And then there was this quite narrow hallway to enter the cafeteria. It was maybe 15 feet wide by maybe 20, 25 feet long. So we were walking down the rotunda, and then we turned the corner to go in. And of course, Nancy and I were in the front so that the guard would recognize us. And the guard stood up immediately and said, "Well, you can't eat here. I'm sorry, you can't get in. This is a private club." And so Nancy and I talked to him and said, "Well, we just ate here yesterday. Don't you remember us?" And he was, of course, very flustered. And he was an old guy and probably a retired cop. I don't know what he was, but he was not with it. And he was quite flustered by this whole situation. He just kept repeating himself, "I'm sorry, you can't eat here, it's a private club." Finally, the manager came out and started to try to reason with us. And then I actually was just reminded because I just read a piece that I wrote way back in 1965 that reminded me that the Secretary of State actually came down to talk to us. And he's trying to tell us that, you know, that they don't really own this cafeteria, that there's some company that's leasing this piece of property and that we should talk to them. And it was in crazy. What are you talking about? This is a public building. And so he was trying to reason, he's trying to reason with us and just trying to get us to leave the corridor. I mean, in the meantime, you know, we came at about 11:30 and now people are starting to come down wanting to eat. And some people, the first few people that came down started to pull out their driver's license or their business card or something saying, I'm a member. And they let a few people in. But then they just stopped the whole thing because it was clear that we were not going to leave. They thought that we would just turn around and leave. And we did not. Then they closed the doors to the cafeteria, which were glass doors, so we could see through what was happening in there. And as the Secretary of State and the manager, they're all trying to talk us out of just walking. They're trying to push us back a little bit, and we're just not going anywhere. We see a line of Arkansas State Police behind the doors. So I think many of us thought that, well, okay, the next step is we'll be arrested, and, you know, we're all expecting to be arrested. This is, you know, what we're expecting to happen. But instead what happened is that they came out and they started pushing and shoving us out of the corridor, shoving us to the floor, beating us with billy clubs. I mean, really being pretty brutal with us. But mostly they were just trying to get us out, and they kept pushing us all the way down this marble floor, down to the marble staircase, to leave the building. And when we got that far, you know, we did leave, so we left. Some people were hurt enough to have to go to the hospital. There was nothing, I don't think anybody was hurt really dangerously. We all got back to the SNCC office and we tried to regroup and we said, well, what are we gonna do? We thought we were gonna get arrested, and they didn't arrest us. And they said, well, I guess we just have to go back tomorrow. So we went back the next day, I think with more people, maybe 20, 25 people. And essentially, the same thing happened, although we didn't go through, I don't think we went through the reasoning part. they skipped that part. Or they probably did come out again, though, briefly to say, now look, you know, you really can't come in here. You know you can't come in here, so try to be reasonable and leave. And we said, we're just not. On the third, they did the same thing. And on the third day, they were even more prepared. They had tear gas canisters with them. And if you've never experienced tear gas, especially in a confined area like that, this is pretty amazing. And I tell people, this is kind of like taking a whole double packet of hot mustard in a Chinese restaurant and just swallowing it. And it's like your whole sinus is exploding and you're crying, you know, the tears are flowing and it's really painful and very uncomfortable. Now, my memory is a little faulty here, and I can't remember if we actually went back the next day or they closed the cafeteria the next day. I know they closed, by the end of the week, they closed the cafeteria. They would rather close the cafeteria than serve people of color. That was the message there. So we decided to sue the state and said, you can't close this cafeteria and you can't deny people to eat in this cafeteria. And the NAACP Legal Defense Fund wrote the suit and prosecuted the case for us. Both Nancy and I testified that we had gone in and eaten without ever being challenged. We got accused of being the defense attorneys wanted to be sure he knew where we were from to prove that we were outside agitators. They didn't quite realize that Nancy was from Virginia, and she pulled out her quite southern accent to say where she was from, and that kind of threw them a little bit. Eventually, the cafeteria is opened again, And just as a little side note, in 1979, I was working for a little regional airline in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and I needed to go to talk to the director of economic development for the state to talk to him about how our airline was going to really be good for the economic development of Arkansas. And we met for a little while, and he says, "Well, why don't we go have some lunch?" And we went over to the cafeteria in the basement of the Capitol building, and which was fully integrated. I mean, people. The tables were integrated. So even by 1979, black people and white people were eating at the same table and talking to each other.
Huh. Did you mention to him that
you know, I didn't, and I'm really sorry I didn't. That's one regret I have, to not mention that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Well, how long were you doing that and in Little Rock?
Okay, so I ended up staying until the fall of 1965. So I was there about 15 or 16 months. I do want to tell one little story about what contributed to my leaving. I mean, maybe I was probably ready to go, I was burned out or whatever it was. But in addition to that, there was now the Black Power Movement getting established. There was a lot of talk about SNCC wanting to be a black organization, and that I don't think at that point people were saying that whites should not be involved, but that, you know, whites needed to take a back seat, if you will. But I was at a national SNCC meeting, and a young girl from Mississippi, she was probably maybe 19 years old, African-American girl, she stood up in front of all these people. I mean, there was lots of people. And she had no fear. It was really quite wonderful. And she said, "You know, I want to be a part of this movement. I want to be able to come in and type the newsletter and run the mimeograph machine and do the jobs to help the movement." She said, "I know I can't. I probably can't type as fast as you white girls from the North. But I want to do it anyway." Well, you know, this really touched me. I thought, you know, why should I be taking a spot from someone like this, a local person who wants to be involved in helping her own life? So I did leave. I went back to Boston, where my roots were, so that, because I had no money. And so my mom said I could come live with her for a while. She thought I was going to live with her for longer, but anyway, I landed a good job, and I got an apartment. And after I was settled for a little while, I started volunteering, which, as I said, I can't seem to stop myself, and I love to do it. But I was tutoring. I mean, I'm a math person, as I said, and I was tutoring kids in math at the local settlement house. And the head of that settlement house was Mel King, who was quite influential. Well, he became even more influential in the Boston area, and African-American person. And he introduced me to a small group of other white people who had worked in the South, who were working with a group called PAR, People Against Racism, and trying to develop programs in the white community about teaching people about race, institutional racism, how racism affects everybody in this country, not just the African Americans. So this was good. We weren't doing a lot except developing a lot of written pieces. We were studying, writing, and making some presentations to students and other in churches, people who were receptive to hearing our message. And then when Martin Luther King was assassinated, the white community in Boston really didn't know how to respond. Harvard students came to us and asked us if we could help them do a student strike and conduct a bit of a freedom school for students. And we had the materials. I mean, we'd been developing these materials. And We also led a march downtown. I think my picture was in the paper, which I didn't know what my mother thought about that. But that was common term, as opposed to having been in the South, where she was, you know, afraid for my life, which I think is probably a reasonable fear that she had. Within about a week or 2 weeks of that that event, we got a call from Detroit PAR. Now, Detroit PAR was a much larger group. They had like 40 or 50 people. And it turns out that there was another group in Philadelphia, People for Human Rights, that was like 15 or 20 people. And there may have been a few other small groups. And there was a call to come to Detroit to talk about forming a national organization. So I went. And we agreed to do it. And some question came up as to who was going to run the office. And I said, if you don't have somebody in Detroit, I'm willing. Mm-hmm. And went home, quit my job again at a moment's notice, probably broke another lease. I did have a friend in Boston where I could store all my stuff.
Well, that's good this time.
So this time, because I, at this point, had, you know, some stuff that was probably worth keeping. Mm-hmm. And this was someone, actually, that I had met through the movement when I was in New York. And she lived in New Jersey then, and then I was in Boston. But that's another story. Mm-hmm. But so I left. I went to Detroit, found myself in a little one, the basement apartment, and was back living on subsistence wages. I just bought a new car, sold it, and bought a junker, and drove to Detroit. And I stayed involved with PAR for another almost 2 years. I met my husband there. Mm. We're still married after 40 lovely years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And a lot was happening at that point. The way the movement was, there were a lot of strains on the movement, from externally and internally, as you know, once the public accommodations bill was passed and the voter rights bill was passed, you know, the explaining racism became more difficult. We all understood that it was still there, and I still believe that it is right now. And I think it's very insidious what is happening. But it's not the easiest thing to communicate, other than, I mean, it's not that I encourage anybody to get hosed or have dogs at them, but that was pretty blatant. You don't see this sort of blatant activity. You didn't, and even in the 70s.
What kind of organizing did you do with PAR, and were people receptive to that?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, we also, we and SNCC also had come out against the war, and we were also against the war. And so part of what we were doing was working with young people, which is where, by the way, my husband, who is organizing youth people, some quite a bit older than him, but that's okay. So we were, one of the things we were doing was trying to educate, for example, the youth, the people who were against the war. We were working to educate them about how race, the role that race played in the war in many ways, not just that there were people of color that we were fighting over there, but most of the troops were people of color, and that kind of thing. So we were trying to, and don't get me on the military industrial complex and all that kind of stuff, but I will tell you about one. So we worked a lot with church groups, again, this was combined with the Youth for Peace, Freedom, and Justice is what that group was called, and they called themselves Yip Fugs. And by the way, that was before Abby Hoffman ever said the word yippie.
Mm-hmm.
So, but whatever. the Methodist Church asked us in some town, I forget which one it was, they asked us, or maybe it was a few churches, because they asked us to run a retreat for this Methodist youth group and try to educate them about race and how it affects them and how it affects people. And what we did, we divided, I mean, it was maybe 200 people. So we divided them into groups and we gave each group a color. And we predetermined which group was going to be the ones that we were going to discriminate against. And we set them up constantly. Yeah, we told them different times for the meetings. They came late. They didn't have resources. They didn't have pencils and paper and all kinds of things. We, you know, I can't remember all the details that we did, but I do remember that the other groups did not find it difficult to jeer at them when they were not acting according to the plan. So we were just amazed at how they were just falling in our trap. The debriefing session on Sunday morning was Sunday afternoon, whatever it was really heart-wrenching. There were a lot of tears shed by the kids and even by us, the facilitators. So that was some of the things, that was some of the stuff we did, and it was pretty powerful.
Did you have, were your SNCC colleagues in par with you? I mean, people you had worked with in SNCC, was there overlap?
No, not any of the people that I had personally worked with, but there were people who had worked for SNCC, I just hadn't met them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them had worked for other organizations, but this was a whole new cadre of people that I met,
mm-hmm.
Which was great.
Yeah. How, you mentioned burnout at one point. How did you sustain yourself through all of this? Because this is so many years of organizing and working.
Well, one of the things we did was we played hard too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that I probably put my colleagues in danger. In Pine Bluff, I dated a local African-American student from Arkansas AM&N College. And he was a rich kid from Little Rock. So he had a motorcycle, and I would ride on the back of his motorcycle in broad daylight, which was probably very bad, very risky behavior. But I did, I mean, we had outlets like this. We had fun. We sang a lot of songs, and that always lifted our spirits to sing freedom songs. I remember also. We did a lot of potlucks in the community, so you know I got to taste a lot of soul food that I'd never been introduced to. That was pretty interesting, There was an occasional time when we went to the local Elks Club. Now, the local Elks Club was where the blues play, you know, bands would come in and play, and we saw heavy star people who are really heavy stars right now. I think B.B. King came through, and Bobby Bootland, and this was all. I always found this really interesting. You go to this club, you bring your own liquor. They don't have liquor licenses. You bring your own liquor in, and you buy setups from them. So they bring out, soda and tonic and, you know, whatever, ginger ale, Coke and lemons and limes. You pay for that. Then the music came and we danced. I mean, and this community, I mean, I was probably the only white person or one of two or three white people in the room. This community accepted me warmly. I don't think they laughed at me when I danced.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to dance.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of, I think, there were ways to relieve tension. We also occasionally went north to took a break and did, a lot of times we would do fundraising, but you got to meet family, you got to see family again and that kind of stuff. So, but I didn't feel like I was at the end of my rope. I do think, I have to say, Arkansas was not Mississippi. There's a big difference. That I think Mississippi and Alabama, you know, people were getting killed there. And a lot of people were getting beat up really badly, and many people were killed. And that was not happening in Arkansas to that extent. I mean, we were, there was definitely harassment, there were definitely, and we did get beat up by the cops when we did that demonstration. And there were other occasions when there was serious, you know, some injury, but you know, this wasn't Mississippi. So we didn't have that kind of pall on us, so.
Did you ever see yourself, did you ever leave the movement, or did the rest of your life kind of reflect all of what you had done?
Well, I have to say that I did leave the movement to some degree. It never left me. This period of my life was life transforming. There's just no other way to describe it. And I feel all of that today. And there were times when I was not involved with anything, and just working and doing whatever else I was doing. But frequently I would find myself back doing something. I'd say over the last, over the last 10 years, I've gotten even back more involved. I'm involved with a group called the Race Relations Council of Northwest Indiana. But I want to say one thing about this too. We're doing, some of the work that we're doing in our study circles, and there's a group in Connecticut now called Everyday Democracy that used to be the Study Circle Resource Center. And I went to a conference of theirs once, a national conference several years back. And I explained to them something, and I don't think even they got it, and these people are the ones that I spoke. But one of the ways that I understand how racism works is that no matter how involved I am, no matter how committed I am, and I have, you know, risked my life and all that, everything, all that. In a moment's notice, I can say, I don't want to do that anymore, and step back, take a step back, and I've just blended into the rest of society, and nobody knows anything about what I am. And I think that's really profound. It's just, I can't wear a sign that says, you know, I believe in civil rights, but I believe in social justice. You know, you just don't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, people of color carry this around with them, whether they like it or not. And I don't know if a lot of people understand that.
Yeah.
That feeling.
Mm-hmm. So
white privilege. It's a.
Yeah.
It's a concept. And the other thing that's interesting, somebody, I can't remember his name now, said, you know, being white in America is not having to think about it, which, you know, I think is really true. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get people to think about it.
Yeah.
Still working on it.
Yeah. It seems like we could use some of your PAR organizing now.
Yeah, well, and I'm, you know, the Race Relations Council of Northwest Indiana, really, my job really is communicating with white people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to communicate with black people, African Americans. I'm still doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
PAR does it, you know, and we could probably use something like that.
Mm-hmm. So when you mentioned that the movement, it really transformed your life, can you talk about in what ways that did? I mean, are there specific things that the movement really changed?
I would say I said this once in a group setting that freaked some people out, but most of the time I'm not proud to be an American. I'm definitely not proud of my history. And I was once. I mean, I thought America was the greatest country in the world, and that our history was the history that any country would want to have. And I don't believe that now. I think what our country really needs is a truth and reconciliation with our past, mm-hmm. and for us to truly recognize what we have done to the Native people who were living here, to the Africans that we brought here, and to the rest of the world that we have essentially colonized economically. That period of my life has informed my politics since then, and informed my view of the world, which is completely different from what it was before. Mm-hmm. And so how does that affect my daily life? That's a tougher question to answer, but I'll say that my husband and I made an attempt to just completely drop out of society and to live on a farm and try to live off the farm. We failed because it's harder than you can possibly imagine it is. But I still view everything that I see in America through the lens of racism. So that's, and I have always done that since I've been an adult, it seems like. So for instance, once I retired, I started to, there's a local university about half an hour from me, and I've been taking history classes and restudying history, and I'm rereading a lot of things. Still continuing to educate myself about our history and mm-hmm. what it means.
So in some of the histories that you've read about the civil rights movement and some of the stuff in the 60s, what have they gotten wrong? I mean, what do you feel has been left out of the story? Because I guess that's a theme that's been kind of talked about throughout this weekend.
Oh, well, I haven't actually studied that part too mm-hmm. much. I mean, I know they don't teach very much about the civil rights movement in school, so I can't really answer
right.
that question.
that's fair.
Yeah. I must say I did take a class that covered the civil rights era and Vietnam War, and I didn't learn that much new stuff about the civil rights movement, but I learned a lot more about the war that I did not know about before, so that was kind of interesting.
There's always more stuff out there.
Yeah.
Huh.
And this teacher was a fairly liberal guy, so he had a viewpoint that mm-hmm. Matched mine to some degree.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you would like to tell me about that I haven't asked or that you feel like you'd like to say?
No, I think that we've really covered it. I will say that I wish I could be more encouraged about the future. So I'm looking forward to tomorrow when the young people are in charge of the day to tell me what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I can figure out a way to help them.
Yeah.
Or step back and just let them do it, which is probably the right thing to do. Since we asked our elders to step aside. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.